Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Mattack. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. Let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the ConsumerWarningNetwork.com by Terry Smiljanic, why this state is to blame for your high credit card interest rates. Bank of America, among others, charges up to 36% interest on credit card debt. How can financial institutions get away with charging customers such historically high interest? Isn't it criminal to do so? Isn't it usurious? If not, who's responsible for letting banks get away with this? Remember when 18% interest was considered high on consumer debt? Remember finance charges of 6%? How did we get from there to here? Enter South Dakota. What is usury? Usury, an ancient concept, is the charging of excessive interest on loans. For millennia, governments and religious authorities have prescribed how much of a fee rich moneylenders can charge for renting their money out to those in need of a loan. Religions actually forbade the charging of any interest at all. The Old Testament, for example, condemned usury. If you lend money to any of my people that is poor by you, you shall not be to him as an usurer, neither shall you lay on him usury. And that's from Exodus 22:25. In 1179, the Catholic Church, Third Lateran Council, declared that persons who accept any interest on loans should be denied the sacraments and Christian burial. Islamic law generally forbids the charging of interest on loans. In the 16th century, King Henry VIII broke with Vatican law, and England enacted a law allowing interest on loans, but capped it at 10% maximum. Thus, the common law, brought over to the United States, at its formation allowed interest charges, but recognized that legislatures had an obligation to the public to see to it that usurious rates by moneylenders were prohibited. The impact of high interest rates. At historically high rates like 36%, a $10,000 loan can balloon to almost twice that amount of debt in just 2 years. And by year five, you would owe almost five times as much as you originally borrowed. Even college student loans can charge usurious rates like 22% that saddle young people when they're most vulnerable. Working at a low-paying entry-level job when you graduate, if you're one of the lucky ones to get a job, makes it near impossible to pay it off. In just 10 years at 22%, you owe more than $73,000 on that $10,000 loan, and you can't even discharge the debt in bankruptcy. You are stuck in life with a millstone around your neck, dragging you down in an ocean of debt. Meanwhile, Bank of America declared a profit of almost $2.5 billion in the second quarter of 2009. Anyone want to try and justify that disparity? Who's to blame? So, how do we get from 10% to 36%? Every state in the union has usury laws prohibiting criminal interest rates, right? Up until 1979, for example, Florida capped interest rates on debts under $500,000 at 10%. during the troubled inflationary period of 79 through 81, when inflation ran at an annual average of 11.7%, Florida raised that cap to 18%. During the last 3 years, with inflation dropping down to 3.3% a year, how can you be charged 36%, twice the Florida cap? Thank your friendly politicians, both Republican and Democrats, with a special shout out to the indefatigable efforts of former Texas Senator Phil Graham and former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin. In 1999, Congress enacted the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, GLBA, with the final deal brokered by Secretary Rubin and signed into law by President Clinton. The act allowed banking institutions to get into the investment banking business, thus allowing the spate of mergers that expanded Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America into financial supergiants. In addition, the Graham-Leach Act slipped in a new twist to usury laws in this country. From now on, a financial institution could charge interest everywhere according to the laws of any state in which it had a branch. What's that all about? South Dakota starts the slide down a slippery slope. As it turns out, the business-friendly state of South Dakota, home of the Sioux Falls Canaries baseball team, has an interesting take on usury law. South Dakota did away with the concept of usury altogether, allowing institutions to charge whatever interest rate they deemed appropriate. 18%? Why not just double that to 36%? Suddenly, South Dakota became a very, very popular state with financial institutions. In fact, Wells Fargo liked the Canaries baseball team so much, it decided to merge all 19 of its bank charters into one big bank, Wells Fargo Bank North America, headquarters in Sioux Falls, where the average January low temperature is 3 degrees. Bottom line, credit card companies no longer have to deal with pesky usury laws. Thanks to banking lobbyists and politicians from both parties, financial institutions are subject to fewer restrictions than the mafia, which still has to deal with local state usury and racketeering laws. Tony Soprano was in the wrong business all along. Unhappy ending. That's the sordid story of how credit card companies can literally charge criminal rates on their credit cards. And what about the original architects of this destruction of our laws? Phil Graham and Robert Rubin? Graham is vice chairman of the investment banking division of financial giant UBS, which just raised the bonuses of its financial managers. Robert Rubin became chairman of Citigroup, where he made more than $126 million in salary and stock in his 8 years of running that company straight into the government bailout. What would these gentlemen say about the plight of those burdened by criminal interest rates? "Stop whining," said former Senator Graham. Even Marie Antoinette, on the eve of the French Revolution, was a little more sympathetic with her suggestion to those without bread. Let them eat cake. In order to combat this, you need to write your congressman. Go to Consumer Warning Network, that's all one word, .com, and you can find links to write your congressman, your representative, and senators, and even a link for the South Dakota legislators. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptek, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So in the second part of the show, in the last couple of months, I've been teaching from the two-income trap, Why Middle Class Parents Are Going Broke by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tiagi. I'll start with the credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. And I also suggest that people visit the archives at www.kruufm.com. under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows that have been produced to help you deal with your debt and to prevent it, to get rid of it, and to have a stable income and expense budget, particularly for middle-class people. Just a little review of what we were discussing last week. That was mom as the all-purpose safety net. This is going back a generation or so, in which the economy was set up so that only one person in the household generally was working, and the other person, often the mom, was at home with the kids, and frankly was a safety net if something went wrong with the family income. The stay-at-home mom was never a cartoon figure. She always wore many hats, changing roles as circumstances demanded. When her husband was working steadily, she would forego a paycheck to spend her days at home, taking care of the children and keeping house. But if circumstances changed, so did she. If her husband was laid off, fired, or otherwise left without a paycheck, the stay-at-home mother didn't simply stand helplessly on the sidelines as her family toppled off an economic cliff. She looked for a job to make up some of that lost income. Similarly, if her husband had a heart attack and was expected to stay at home for a while, she could find work and add a new income source to help the family stay afloat financially. A stay-at-home mother served as the family's ultimate insurance against unemployment or disability, insurance that had a very real economic value even when it wasn't drawn on. The realities of a father losing his job are varied and complex. Researchers have found, for example, that a woman whose husband loses his job is more likely to enter the workforce if her children are older, perhaps because the higher cost of daycare for small children can make a young mother's return to work too costly. Some long-time stay-at-home mothers may find that they lack marketable skills. Others may be frustrated that only low-wage jobs are available to them. A stay-at-home wife may have difficulty finding work when layoffs, such as the one that caught her husband, are making jobs scarce in their locale, as we can see across the country right now with the huge job loss dilemma. However, notwithstanding these difficulties, there is considerable evidence that as a family's economic position deteriorates, stay-at-home wives do exactly what one might predict. They look for a job. Sociologists have found that a woman is far more likely to enter the workforce if her husband takes a permanent wage reduction, if he faces an extended period of unemployment, or if he receives little or no unemployment compensation. This, of course, squares with common sense. It's the safety net. Researchers have found that the effect of wives' added income is not trivial. For the average married man who loses his job, his wife's new income offsets more than 25% of his lost wages. That all-purpose insurance policy provided by the stay-at-home mother has paid off for millions of families. Back a generation ago, not only did stay-at-home wives serve as backup workers, insuring against their husband's loss of income, they were also available when the family had unexpected expenses. If there was an illness in the family, a stay-at-home mother could go to work to cover the deductibles, co-payments, and other medical expenses not covered by insurance. If the family was uninsured, a stay-at-home mother could join the estimated 4 to 5 million women who now stay in full-time jobs just so they can provide health insurance for their families. Now, what about divorce? Divorce is the single most common trigger for stay-at-home wives to enter the workforce. During the 1970s, when fewer than half of all married women were in the labor force, 83% of divorced women were working within 2 years of separation from their husbands. A sudden need for cash can arise from all sorts of causes, both good news and bad news. The good news is my child got into an Ivy League school, or the bad news is that Termites have eaten away at the foundation of the house. Either way, though, the key point remains the same. Families with the stay-at-home mother have a backup earner, someone who can add a jolt of income to the household, a jolt that can make the difference between covering the kids' tuition and keeping up with the doctor's bills, rather than giving up health insurance or taking on a second mortgage. In addition to playing the role of a backup earner, the stay-at-home mother plays another critical economic role, backup caregiver. The full-time homemaker does more than change diapers and check homework. She is available to provide extra care for anyone, child or adult, who needs it. She is on hand to care for an elderly relative who can no longer take care of himself. 3 out of 4 caregivers to disabled elderly, excluding husbands and wives, are daughters, daughters-in-law, or other female relatives and friends, such as nieces or granddaughters. A generation ago, the majority of these women did not work outside the home. If granddad has become too frail to manage on his own, the stay-at-home mother is available for the myriad of tasks not covered by Medicare. She can help him dress every morning, drive him to the doctor's office, balance his checkbook, or just keep him company. And because she is at home full-time, she can perform these tasks without taking off from her own job or forcing her family to live without a paycheck they had been counting on. A mother who has gone into the workplace brings home a paycheck, but she forfeits the economic value of her backup role. So long as nothing goes wrong, the trade-off is a simple choice between two viable alternatives. Some families prefer to have mom at home and are willing to live with less money. Others accommodate a working mother and enjoy a richer lifestyle. When trouble strikes, however, the family learns that the two choices may not have been as equivalent as they had deemed. Only one leaves the family with a safety net. When a mother is at home and not working and things start to erupt unexpectedly, for example, an illness of someone in the family, there's new bills, there's no new money, there's the old bills of utilities, car payments, and the basic needs that sometimes get diverted to try to deal with the most aggressive creditor calling or coming to the door. So it all gets juggled for a while and then jumbled into a horrific mess. And frankly, this is often the time when people see a bankruptcy lawyer because it's just out of hand. And they want to get some stability, clarity, and sanity back in their lives. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I've been talking about mom as the all-purpose safety net, and looked at how this really was the standard a generation ago, and certainly not the standard today. Although it could, for many families, still be quite useful, particularly if she can step into the workforce if the need arises for new money. We also saw that if she can't, and there is no new money, and something comes up, then this is often a reason for people to file bankruptcy. Not every two-income family will face the financial crisis that hits the families that need bankruptcy. Whether they do depends in large part on how they spend the second salary, and that's an important thing. The single breadwinner family, by definition, plans its financial commitments geared to a single income. A stay-at-home mother is a contingent worker called on only in an emergency. In ordinary times, the family lives on one paycheck. In theory, the two-income family could take the same approach. They could spend one paycheck and keep the second one in reserve. If disaster strikes, they will have ample savings to cushion any blow. Also, the two-income family has another budgeting alternative. They can do exactly what the overconsumption camp claims they do. Blow the second paycheck on expensive vacations, gadgets for the house, brand name clothes, and dozens of other things they don't really need. While this strategy might make the finger waggers sputter with indignation, these families would actually be just as prepared for an emergency as their one-income counterparts. If something goes wrong, they can simply stop purchasing the extras without any harm to the family's standard of living, while mom returns to her role as backup earner or caregiver. If dad loses his job, mom's income will be reallocated to cover the family's living expenses while her husband looks for a job. Over the past 25 or 30 years, mothers poured into the workplace, but they did not fritter away their paychecks on buying sprees that could be abandoned at the first sign of trouble. Nor did they lock that money in the bank. Millions of two-income families use the second income to purchase opportunities for their children, a home in a safe neighborhood with good schools, a comprehensive health insurance policy, two reliable cars, preschool, and college tuition. They made the long-term commitments to ongoing expenses, and they counted on both incomes to make ends meet. So, with the contemporary modern two-earner family, if the husband lost his job, the wife would still be working. She would be earning less on the average, but it would be considerably more than her counterpart wife would have earned a generation earlier. With the contemporary husband's unemployment check, the couple's annual earnings would be well ahead of the couple's post-layoff situation a generation ago. But there is one very critical difference. The couple from a generation ago were accustomed to living on less money, whereas the contemporary couple had built their lives around an income which was 75% more on the average than the couple a generation ago, of course adjusted for inflation. So the modern couple, when they get a shortfall in income, it's much more severe. Compared with a one-income couple, the modern two-income couple are very poorly positioned to absorb a drop in income. Their fixed monthly expenses are 2.5 times higher than the couple from a generation ago back in 1973. So they have less discretionary money left over, even when they are both fully employed. Without the modern husband's paycheck, the modern couple doesn't have a prayer of making ends meet. Even if the modern husband finds a job within a few months, the family will continue to operate from a deficit, since there will be no extra income available to pay off the debts that mounted up while his paycheck was gone. So this is a sharp contrast to the couple from a generation ago. If the former stay-at-home mother stays in the workforce temporarily, the couple should regain his financial footing within a few months of her husband's reemployment back in the day. Proponents of the overconsumption myth would be quick to point out that the modern couple don't actually need all of that money, 75% more than the couple from a generation ago with two people working, that they should be able to get by on 30% less income, especially in comparison to the couple from a generation ago who was getting along just fine with that amount of money, holding on to their spot in the middle class on the substantially 30% lower yearly income. However, the modern couple have signed binding contracts and long-term mortgages, made commitments and promises that depended on all of the income from both spouses working. They could, and in all likelihood would, cut back around the edges. They might cancel cable TV or eliminate takeout dinners. They could postpone replacing certain things like the carpet and take unnecessaries off the shopping list. But the effect of such belt tightening would be modest at best. They cannot make up for the almost 30% hole in the family's budget by eating less or foregoing a new pair of sneakers. So where does that leave them? In order to pull back to a 30% reduced family budget, they would need to sell their home, trade in their car, pull their younger child out of preschool, and enroll their older child in a lower cost after-school daycare center, a process that would take months to accomplish. Again, we're giving an example with a standard family. And the normal response is that they would be unlikely to take such draconian measures until they were already deep in financial trouble and forced to admit that the lives they once lived were gone forever. It's actually a natural response. Now, the consumption finger waggers might not be willing to exonerate the modern couple, but it is important to notice something about their expenditures that turns the standard financial analysis on its head. The modern couple are vulnerable precisely because they did not overconsume on trinkets. They are vulnerable because they made long-term commitments to what most would consider sensible family purchases: housing, education, health insurance. When they're in a predicament, they probably don't want to hear it, but the modern day couple would be more secure financially if they had whooped off the wife's entire salary on big screen TVs and trips to the Bahamas, because those purchases do not require an ongoing financial commitment. So that, according to Professor Warren and Amelia, is the truth about the data that we see regarding modern family spending. Should the modern couple have saved one income, locking it in the bank for rainy days is a very good question. But even there, the picture must be etched in shades of gray rather than black and white, because money in the bank is great, but so are college degrees, decent medical care, and homes in good school districts, all of which the typical family spent its money on. So the modern wife might ask the overconsumption critics and the financial planners, what would be the point of working if she couldn't spend money to better the lives of her children? She wasn't sending her kids to daycare every day just so she could go on a cruise or plan some glorious retirement for herself and her husband. These are true middle-class values. The family, cash savings, money for retirement, treats, and vacations could come later. The couple decides that the children needed a good home now, good daycare now, and good health insurance now. Many parents, and even a fair number of financial analysts, would agree with them. And next week, we'll look at how families got sucked into the two-income trap. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, please call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeindebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.